You're listening to the Reinvest Podcast, where each Tuesday we will show you how to reclaim, reconnect, and refocus your life by bringing you the top real estate professionals in the industry. We'll pull back the curtain so you can implement these tools and tactics to build generational wealth. Your hosts, Garrett Gatton and Seth Simonillo.
What's up, Reinvest listeners? I'm trying to switch up our intros here. Okay. Sorry, I'm getting carried away. Episode 64 of the Reinvest Podcast. We're live in the studio here with another young professional in the financial realm, Jacob Chrysler, which is a sick name, by the way.
Thank you. I probably should have gone into car sales, but maybe not Chrysler car sales. Been of a rough stretch.
Yeah, there you go. Is there any money coming to you?
No. No A-share dividends, unfortunately, not for my family.
You don't get
bad.
The Z plan on any of their vehicles, huh?
No.
Well, you should do like, what's that? When you type into the Google to find out where you're from, ancestry.com. You should do that. That'd be worth $20 to figure out if you're related.
I think somebody in my family has done that and came up empty.
I already found out that's a dead end.
Yeah,
huh?
Probably found out some... probably more negative things than positive.
Yeah, that's funny. Like,
it's probably
crap.
The worst.
Didn't want to know that.
Yeah, didn't want to know.
Well, so you're a financial guy, which is an exciting podcast for us because we kind of live in the world of real estate investing.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a switch up, but hopefully we can kind of flesh things out for people about how this could fit into their investment strategy, their retirement strategy. So you're with Empower.
Yes.
And you would call yourself a financial advisor.
Financial advisor and a certified financial planner.
Yep. Okay. So the average person, like explain.
What does that mean?
What does that give you the power to do?
Hopefully not a lot of power per se, enabling others perhaps. Certified financial planner professional is an accreditation from the board of certified financial planners. Basically, it's a designation designed to inform the average person that the financial professional they're working with will be acting in a fiduciary capacity, much like a doctor or a lawyer, where there's privilege.
There's legal obligation to how you represent them.
And I have to act in their best interest, right?
What a concept.
Which is radical, unfortunately, in the world of finance, because not a lot of financial professionals have that obligation because... there are obviously conflicts of interest involved in financial services. You know, everybody's trying to make money, right? And so, you know, disclosing those potential conflict of interests is of utmost importance. Obviously, you know, everybody has a lot of healthy skepticism about the stock market because, you know, there's the history of crashes and you know, dating back to the early 1900s, of course, that's where a lot of our current regulation comes from, actually, is from that era.
Wow. Like the Great Depression?
From the Great Depression era, and just all the follow-up with that. And there's a lot of folks that are doing, they're acting what's called the suitability rather than fiduciary standard. So what's suitable, what could help them, it may not be the quote unquote best option. And so that allows them to, recommend a certain product to somebody. But a fiduciary has to not only look at the products available at their own firm, but also, you know, recognizing that, hey, we may not be the best fit for you and not trying to fit, a square peg into a round hole per se, just because, they have a product to sell doesn't mean they should sell it.
So it's radical, but that probably helps give the clients you work with some peace of mind that there's some accountability. I mean, A, you're going to do it because it's who you are. And B,
exactly.
There's an overlay, just it's that accountability for that to happen. And was it fair to say that most people don't know if their financial advisor has a fiduciary responsibility to them?
I think that once people meet a financial advisor, they find out, but I don't think there's a well-known understanding of how that actually plays
out. Means.
A lot of it, we're as financial professionals, a lot of it comes down to how do you get paid?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I think that question determines, whether people are fiduciaries or not is how their financial advisor gets paid.
Gotcha.
That's something that will determine, you know, if they're acting in a fiduciary capacity. And I want to say something very clearly. Just because somebody is not a fiduciary does not mean that they are not doing a good job or don't have a very important role right. in the financial world.
Right.
Right.
So I just want to say that up front. I'm not
disclaimer.
Yeah. I'm not.
You're not putting down somebody who's right. not a fiduciary. It's
right. Just kind of it's just going in eyes wide open. You know, how is your financial advisor getting paid?
And we're going to talk about that.
If you ask that question, you'll get some interesting answers.
Yeah, there you go. So that's for you listening. That's your next, surprise your financial advisor with that question. Hey, I just been thinking, how do you get paid off of what I do? But let's back up just a little bit, Jacob. Tell us, how did you get on this route of doing the financial planning?
I love this question. So I was sitting with a college friend and teammate of mine, and I'll give him a shout out because he's local, Clint Spencer, of the Spencer Realty name. I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like Ron Spencer.
Yeah, I believe that's Clint's uncle.
Okay,
hopefully
nice.
I'm not messing that up. But Clint was my catcher at Mount Vernon Nazarene.
Wow.
Where we played baseball together. He had me over my freshman year, first fall break, and he opened my eyes to the world of Roth IRAs.
And how did he do that?
Well, because Clint is probably one of the for a 20-year-old, he was by far the most financially literate person that
wow.
I knew.
Wow!
Both my parents are teachers, and so public school teachers. My mom was a stay-at-home mom at the time, and so my dad was a teacher for the state. And so for state teachers, most of them. Have a traditional pension plan. So their retirement's pretty much taken care
right,
of for them.
Right.
So like in my house growing up, finances wasn't specifically retirement planning was not really talked about because it was right. taken care of, right? It wasn't something that the individual had to take care of. It was done kind of for you.
Through their employer.
Exactly. So when Clint and I were just up talking, it just kind of came up out of nowhere because Clint just lives and breathes business. According to legend, you know, he was one of the kids, you know, at 6 years old who had a Roth IRA because he was selling Buckeye necklaces down at Ohio State before games on Saturdays.
What a legend.
Dude. Yeah. I mean, just
and
has always been
tied
grinding.
Into the Ron Spencer lineage too. So it comes
yeah.
by honestly.
Yeah. So always a very entrepreneurial kind of guy. And so he got me into it. He introduced me to the financial planning professor, Mount Vernon, Dr. Kelly Rush. I'll give you a shout out. She's awesome. And so she sold me on becoming a financial planning, it was a minor at the time. I think it's a major now.
Did she sell you an actual financial plan?
No, she did not. just the concept of working with people and educating them, because I, like my parents, have the heart of a teacher. But when I was doing my undergrad work in education, I realized I kind of hated teenagers. Ooh. So I figured I probably shouldn't
pivot.
Work with teenagers. And so,
smart.
You know, educating adults and finances is, you know, a numbers thing. And I was a math major and finance minor.
You know, some adults are glorified teenagers. So,
well, you know, I think we probably all run into them still. But yeah, that's how I got into finance and then, you know, kind of worked my way through a couple of different companies
yeah.
and I'm here now with Empower.
So, a few weeks ago, we had a podcast release that was about the stock market with Stephen Speck. We kind of contrasted investing in stocks and, you know, with investing in real estate. And so today with your financial planner,
yeah.
But you do a lot of retirement planning with people
yes.
currently. So we would like to kind of dive in on the retirement side of the stock market, you know, the Roth yeah. IRAs, the 401ks, some of those investment vehicles for retirement purposes.
So let's start with this to kick that off. On a scale of 1 to 10, what level of awareness does the average consumer have about their finances in relation to retirement?
I think it depends on what you define as average. So, you look at a lot of studies coming out about, you know, what people have saved. And if you look across the entire swath of the U.S. populace, it's shocking how little people have saved.
Yeah.
Mm. You want to talk about the broadening wealth gap, perhaps many of your listeners are on the better side of that. But the other side definitely exists and is getting larger. So I would say on average, probably a 1 or a 2.
Mm.
amongst your listeners. I hope it's a 10 because they listen to you guys every week.
That's right.
So what's that? What's that number? Maybe on an average.
I'm gonna misquote it, but it's like, I mean, most people, barely have $2,000 saved. I mean, I think Dave,
like in their checking account.
Yeah, Dave Ramsey talks about that all the time. Yeah. There was also a study that came out recently, and I'm not going to be able to have the source for you, but it was basically just talking about how over the last 2 years, during a significant time of market volatility and a lot of turmoil in the economy, they've seen a record redemption of retirement plans, of redemptions from retirement plans, meaning people have cashed in their 401ks
to use those funds early.
Just to live their lives, right? So before retirement, and it's a pretty big problem because, you know, the social burden of that on the general population, right? It's like we're going to have, you know, people not being able to afford their retirement, right? Yeah, so that just puts a lot of negative pressures on society, kind of on a macro level. I would say, how much does the average investor know? Slim to none.
Yeah.
And that's just about their own retirement plan.
Right.
You know, then there's, okay, what do you actually put into the retirement plan? And ultimately, that's really what matters. I mean, like we were kind of talking off air.
Yep.
You know, understanding the tax code, which, you know, what is a 401k? What's a 403b? What's a 457? These are all just line items in the tax code that dictate how you can invest your money,
right?
What can you put, what wrapper can you put around it? Well, what the candy inside is ultimately what matters, right? And I think people know even less about that.
So comment on, so you kind of touched on two things. You have the demographic of people who are older and are maybe on the verge of retirement or into retirement, and they're affected by rapid inflation.
Yeah.
Maybe the lack of financial literacy and discipline early on that allowed them to then have a nest egg to facilitate the lifestyle they want.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of left with the ramifications of that,
yep.
which is tough. It's hard to change that because time is a huge variable in all of this. But backing up, there's another demographic of people who are younger. Maybe they're into their professional career or graduating college and on the verge of that. And they can make decisions now that would set them up, you know, to have that retirement in hand. Now, the question is, how much do you, like somebody young, let's say 30s, okay, or younger, what's the conversation around Social Security and relying on that by the time we're 60, 65?
There have been PhDs.
There is no conversation.
There have been PhDs a lot smarter than me, economists that have written about the future of Social Security.
Or the lack thereof.
I think they will ultimately be the ones that our government officials rely on for those solutions because, you know, these politicians, we'll just leave it at that. But, you know, that's how policy gets implemented. They call in some, you know, some people to make recommendations or, you know, go to the
right.
The reality is that Social Security tax is not going away.
Right.
Right.
Which is the main source of funding for Social Security. I think it's very easy to look to the news and say, oh, look what's happening in France, right? The French, you know, their social net, whatever you want to call it over there, has been attacked, by the government, and so people are rioting, have been, you know, there's been civil unrest because of their taking Social Security away. Are they going to try that in America, you know, the most heavily armed populace in the world? I don't know.
Yeah.
People, you joke casually about Social Security going away, but the actual ramifications of that would be pretty catastrophic.
But a lot of what we're talking about, though, is I understand there'll be consequences, but we off camera, we talked about this. There's also consequences of printing money.
Right.
And they can keep doing it, but at some point, by choice or by default, there's going to be a consequence.
Right.
So will they choose to get rid of Social Security? Probably not. but will there be a choice? You know what I mean? Like there's...
The thing is, I think it's very easy to you know, feel like the extreme outcome is the most possible. Again, I'm not an expert on it, but the more likely solution, in my opinion, is that it'll just be modified, which would also be very harmful.
Right.
But to, you know, to tell people that Social Security is going to zero, that's like saying the stock market going to zero or the value of your home going to zero, right? That's like one of these,
so
like
extreme,
a fear-mongering tactic, in my opinion.
So, but on a practical level, you have to have a conversation with somebody that's speculative.
Social Security was never designed to be the main source of retirement income for people.
Right, and that's probably the starting point, right?
Correct. And I think that's another misconception that people falsely believe to be true.
They almost use that, at least I'll have that.
Yeah, it's like, no, like that was never the intent.
Right.
Social Security has grown and grown and grown to include more and more people for good intended reasons, I think. But how that actually plays out, you know,
that's just a piece of the overall retirement strategy.
You know, I think the traditional model of Social Security, and this is probably, you know, something that's more radical in the last 20 years, 30 years, and goes into my assessment of people's financial literacy being so low. Original retirement planning was kind of a three-pronged attack. You would have Social Security, a traditional pension plan, and retirement income from real estate, investments, things of that nature. One of those three has almost completely disappeared from corporate America.
Pensions.
The pensions.
Ha, got it.
Gone.
Good job.
You can't find a pension anywhere anymore unless you have like a government job or it's like a well-established business.
Well, and they're even getting rid of them in the military. So, I mean, they're still going away, even if you have a government job.
At a government level,
If you become a teacher now, I think you get like three options. And a lot of times you can choose to have like a 401k as a teacher, which I think is appealing to a lot of people because they don't know if they want to be teachers forever. But again, like time is an asset. So the longer you stay in a system, you're going to benefit fully from that system the longer you're in it, right? So working for a system that has a pension for 30 years, you know, that's going to do you okay. And there's a lot of teachers that are retiring right now or that will be retiring soon that I don't think they really understand how good they have it compared to somebody that's just starting out.
That's very true, actually. My uncle is right on the bubble. So the state of Ohio just made some changes a couple years ago to their teacher pension.
Yeah.
And I don't understand it totally well, but essentially it was how many years you had to put in compared to the percentage of your income that you would get back in retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just on the bubble of being grandfathered in.
Mm-hmm.
But that change goes into effect for anybody else who's already in the teacher system, the union, and then also going into it.
Yeah.
And that has huge financial ramifications for probably an underpaid position already. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those are real changes that are happening. So for the kind of narrowing our focus a little bit today, the realm that we play in, we work with a lot of business owners, a lot of entrepreneurs.
Right.
We are those as well. So we're talking about 1099 income for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are W-2 and do the 401k and the employee match, you know, that might be set up through their employer. But most real estate investors, their answer for retirement is more real estate.
Right.
So for the plain devil's advocate, what would you say to a real estate investor that their answer is, well, I've got my rental properties, I've got 10 of them, they're going to be paid off, and you know, I'm going to cash flow 10 grand a month, and that's my retirement.
Yeah.
Where does what you talk about with the IRAs and different things like that fit into someone's portfolio that's just 1099, they don't have maybe a traditional retirement account set up?
Uncle Sam. So I think one of the biggest pieces of retirement planning is tax planning. Yeah, how do you keep what you've worked so hard to acquire?
Right.
Which that's a long-term question, which is why people don't think about it.
It's a very important but not urgent question.
That's well
and
said.
By default, we in our human nature, we tend to push those kinds of questions off until they become urgent. And right. The problem is they are never urgent until they are very urgent.
That's good.
And so I would say if you look at a 1040, the AGI, right? The adjusted gross income, which on the 2023 1040 is line 11. Real estate goes into that calculation. Real estate income,
okay,
is my understanding. You know what doesn't go into that calculation? Roth distributions.
Okay,
so it's tax free. So, if you're, you know, and we were talking off air about like, can you invest in real estate in a Roth IRA, Roth 401k. It sounds like, you know, might be possible. I personally don't know that answer. However, what I do know is that just traditional dividend income or rental income, that's considered taxable. Right. So as we kind of been talking about here so far early on the podcast, it sounds like we all kind of at least agree that the government is in a bit of a mess, right? So how are they going to try to fix that mess?
Right.
One of the easy ways to do that is to raise tax rates.
Yeah, it's right? Kind of like anytime we know you have
that
a business.
We know that tax rates can change because right. They changed under President Trump. They're going to change again here right. Soon when that sunsets.
And we know they're not going down.
It would be impossible for them to go down, it would seem, right? So if you are of the opinion that tax rates are going to be higher in the future, wouldn't it make sense to try to get more of your assets into investment vehicles that are, you know, potentially never going to be taxed again? Not just the principal, but the interest,
right?
Right? Tax-free interest, right? That's like the holy grail.
Right, which is why people love Roth IRAs.
Right, and there's also Roth options within 401ks. I believe some 457 plans have Roth options. And the nice thing about a 401k compared to an IRA is the contribution level is higher. So you can typically shove more money into a 401k right. than you can a Roth IRA in terms of contributions.
Is it like $7,200 a year for the IRA?
It changes. So for people under 50, it's, I believe, $6,500 this year. So you have until December 31st. Well, you have it up until you file, so you can do previous year contributions up until the time you file for 2023. That's $6,500
if you're a 401k?
For an IRA.
For an IRA.
Per person. So if you file with your spouse, you can put in twice that amount.
Well, you'd have to open a separate spousal account. You'd have to open a spousal IRA.
Gotcha.
For 2024, it went up $500. So if you're under 50, you can throw in $7,000 a year. If you're over 50, you just add 1,000.
Any predictions on if they will get rid of the Roth IRA?
I have no predictions. I mean, there's a lot of money tied up in those investment vehicles. I mean, it certainly have to grandfather that process. But I mean, right. 401ks are such a staple of corporate America right now. Eliminating the Roth, I mean, that would cause quite a ripple. And there's already so much money in tax deferred retirement plans anyway.
Right.
I think that there would have to be enough of a shift where that's like so much new money's going into Roth IRAs and 401ks to move the needle to where like people are realizing, oh, government's not going to get all the revenue we thought we were. I mean, it's absurd how much more money people typically have in tax deferred rather than Roth.
Well,
so what's
point.
Yeah? Okay. What's the difference between real quick? We're talking about a lot of 401k stuff, Roth IRAs, and then there's IRAs. Can you just give real entry level? What is a 401k? Mm-hmm. What is the difference between that and an IRA or a Roth IRA?
So an IRA stands for Individual Retirement Arrangement, is what that abbreviation stands for, and that, like it sounds, it's an individual account. It's not associated with any sort of corporation. There's different types of bankruptcy and federal protection if things happen with your investments. 401ks have a little bit different protection than IRAs. But basically, they're essentially a way that you can contribute money specifically for retirement. So there's rules in place that limit your ability to take the money out before what's considered normal retirement age, which the IRS views as 59 and a half is like the early retirement. So if you try to spend your money before 59 and a half out of a retirement account,
you penalize or something,
there are penalties that start to come into play. Doesn't mean you can't take it out, but there is a penalty.
So earlier when we were talking, which I think it would be good to kind of unfold this, the mindset or the thinking behind a Roth IRA, mm-hmm. where taxes could go, mm-hmm. and why it would be prudent potentially to start one. Mm-hmm. How do you counsel people that way?
So Roth sounds great, tax-free growth, right? There is a cost to it up front. You're putting in contributions after tax is the idea.
You're still getting hit on the front end.
So it gets included. So let's say you have $100,000 and you want to contribute to some sort of Roth IRA or a Roth 401k. And I probably should finish my definition of explaining. So 401ks are through a company, right? So, and that has different rules that allow you to put more money in. So that's one of the main differences is you can put more money into a 401k than you can an IRA. But the main function is it's an after-tax contribution. So if you have $100,000 and you put $5,000 into a what's called a tax-deferred account, so like a traditional 401k, or what you'll see, you know, on a 401k for a company, it'll say pre-tax contributions. Yeah. If you did it that way, your gross income would be reduced equivalently by $5,000. So now you're paying less in the current tax year because you basically get to write off that contribution. A Roth contribution is made with after-tax dollars. So your gross income would still be $100,000 even though you put in $5,000 this year. Right. So you don't get the tax write-off. So you have to pay taxes on that money now. And then the deal is, okay, you paid the taxes up front, then assuming you meet some basic qualifications like waiting until 59 and a half, or there's a 5-year rule that you have to be aware of, and there's other stipulations, but assuming you can jump through those hoops, which most people do as long as they wait until retirement to access, then you can take out the money, including the gains, tax-free. And the ripple effect of that is pretty awesome because Medicare premiums are based on adjusted gross income. Mm-hmm. So let's say you have $20,000 of rental income that you're flowing in. You might say, well, great, but you know, nobody wants to have to pay extra in medical costs, right? If you could show more money coming in through the Roth, which doesn't show up on the 1040 as taxable income, you might be able to reduce your medical premiums for Medicare. Your Social Security tax. You know, there's a lot of people that like we were talking about that are living on Social Security. You know, if they have a pension coming in that's taxable or other retirement accounts or rental income, more of their Social Security gets taxed. All of that money goes into adjusted gross income, and that determines a lot about what your tax rate will be. You know, also like capital gains tax, short-term capital gains for a non-retirement account, long-term capital gains, even long-term capital gains are included in your adjusted gross income. Even though they're taxed at a separate rate,
right,
they still go into your adjusted gross income number. So strictly in terms of, okay, if I'm trying to, you know, be smart about paying my taxes, I'm not even necessarily talking about tax avoidance, because you're still, when you're making a Roth contribution, you're still paying the tax now. But getting yourself into a situation where you have flexibility, I think that's a pretty valuable thing for people, even when they're retired and, you know, maybe consider themselves on autopilot.
So we talked to one of our investors, and he made a comment over lunch in the last year, and he had said right now taxes are on sale. which was an interesting statement, mm-hmm. right? And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the thought process is taxes historically are at an all-time low.
Yeah.
And for the variables that we're talking about at a government level, at an economic level, even at a global level, it's reasonable to think the taxes are going to be higher significantly in the foreseeable future at some point, which kind of ties into the Roth IRA conversation,
yeah.
right? So what, for somebody looking to diversify their portfolio, what percentage of their income should they allocate? Should they max every year the Roth contribution, or how would they figure out how much money they should be shoveling into a product like that?
So unfortunately, I'm not a CPA. I'm not a tax professional. I'm going to let people talk to their tax professional and find that answer out for themselves, or talk to somebody that can give tax planning advice. Because like we were saying earlier, you know, if you're asking these questions too late, it's kind of hard to unwind in many cases. But if you can plan for it, I would say, you know, having a diversified approach, not just to your investment strategy, but to your tax planning strategy as well. So, you know, there are certainly some benefits to getting a tax write-off. There are some benefits to having tax-free income. It doesn't necessarily have to be an all or nothing proposition.
Right.
But I would say, you know, if you feel like, man, I've got a lot of my eggs in one basket, that basket being real estate, it may not only be concentrated in, from an investment planning standpoint, but you know, you may have a pretty vanilla situation, you know, when you're retired and filling out that 1040, you know, all of your income showing up on that AGI number. So
yeah, and like, I know you're yeah. you can't speak to this, and you alluded to it earlier, but for our listeners, I would encourage you look up self-directed IRA. We know of a couple people, Seth and I, that are using self-directed IRAs, and I'd have to check if it's Roth or traditional. You might be able to do either. But essentially, it's a way that you could potentially invest in real estate through that vehicle if you still wanted to do real estate, but you kind of wanted that model mm-hmm. of a tax, you know, pre-tax account that then you could rely on later as an investment vehicle.
Yeah, I would just strongly remind people that if you're using an IRA, I mean, it's in the name. It's a retirement account.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And I think a lot of people get into real estate because they want to retire early, like at 50, mm. right? I want to be financially independent at like 40 or 50, yeah, which right. is a great aspiration, right? But IRAs and 401ks are set up under what the IRS's definitions of retirement are, which, you know, it used to be 62 was like considered retirement age, you know, back when Social Security was started. It was like,
right,
all right, they'll start collecting Social Security at 62 and die by the time they're 65.
Perfect.
And you know, we'll pay them Social Security for 3 years. And, you know, all the actuaries were really happy about that because, you know, their liabilities for Social Security were
decreased
3 years long. And then all of a sudden, modern medicine shows up and everybody's living until they're 95.
Grandma,
and oh my
Grandpa.
Gosh, Social Security has to fund people until they're, you know, super old. And that just blows up all the
and
all
the longer
math.
This is just like, you yeah. know, it's kind of an objective statement. It sounds a little morbid, but the older you get, the reliance on medical assistance goes higher and higher and higher, right?
Right.
So there's like a burden there too. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Yep.
What's kind of the biggest misnomers of retirement accounts that you've seen over the last 8 years of you being in this industry?
I wouldn't necessarily say misnomers, but I think just as human beings, we remember the pain a lot more than we remember the good. And I'm amazed when I'm talking to clients how quickly they reference like the tech bubble crashing or 2008, like I don't want to lose money again. You know, you look at the returns of the S&P, the Dow, which hit all-time highs last week, you know, the NASDAQ since 2008. I mean, it's astounding. Yet, you know, you'll get people, young people even, so, you know, those pain points in our history as investors, and I think it's probably true of some of your own investors that they got into real estate because of some of those events.
Right.
Right. Oh my gosh, I lost all this. I was, you know, saving this money into a into a retirement account and I lost all my money and what's the point, right? I got to take control of myself, right? And you know, a lot of people don't necessarily have, you know, the skill set or the desire to do their own real estate. So, you know, throwing in the towel on the stock market, you know, it might be a bit premature. And I certainly feel for investors that, you know, lived through, you know, the lost decade of 2000, you know, because you had the tech crash and then you had 2008 mm-hmm. right after that. I mean, that's brutal. And that's another reason to diversify for sure. Like, you know, you don't want to have all your eggs in that basket either, right? You know, right. Especially when you're about to retire.
Yeah.
Certainly. But just, a lot of people will be so quick to reference, you know, these black swan events and not look at the data when it comes to like how they should be investing mm-hmm. and just living in that past too long and not thinking about the future.
Because part of the problem is that the fear set in, people pulled out maybe back in 2008.
What's happened again this year? I mean,
right. And if they would have just stayed in and hung it, you know what I mean? If they would have just waited it out as, yeah. you know, long-term investing, you should. I mean, they would have got back tenfold. You know what I mean? What maybe they had in there at one point. So
yeah,
it's, and the same thing's in real estate. I mean, people panic and they maybe jump out or sell their property or whatever. Then you talk to them and they're like, man, I wish I never would have sold.
Man, if I had a dollar every time I had a conversation with somebody like that. I'd have like $10.
I think a lot of people investing in general, retirement investing and just even, you know, maybe shorter term investing, they don't invest long enough. They don't wait out the investment long enough. And I guess yep. the same is true for retirement planning because you got to be patient. You have to be patient with letting that money sit there.
Yeah.
And you have to learn to function, like to live your life not using that money. And I think for a lot of people, like you said, the financial illiteracy, people just don't know how to manage their own finances. And so planning for something that's 50 years down the line seems impossible because they need to live off that money now.
Right. And that, so, that is a reality for a lot of people.
And I think that's probably why people in your field, I mean, it's super wise for someone to get linked up with a financial advisor, someone that can start giving them the wisdom now at mm-hmm. 20, 25, 30, 35, to have the foresight to actually plan ahead.
There's also just a lot of initiative that you can take. I mean, there's so much just written knowledge out there, you know, just like there is for real estate, I'm sure. There's lots of, if you just take the time and the initiative, but you know, like you were just saying, it's very difficult, I think, for a lot of people to wait that long to see returns. We have such short attention spans and it's only getting worse.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
only getting worse.
I would encourage people. I've seen this in my own life. I've talked to a lot of people who this reality has been true of them as well. In the moment, when you think about peeling off a portion of your income to allocate towards investment, whatever it is, real estate, you know, an IRA or something like that, you think, how can I do that? And it's always shocking to me that when you make that jump, your lifestyle literally adjusts to what you have.
Yep.
And so, you know, you were talking about your home equity line of credit, how
yeah.
when you know that you've deployed that money on an investment, it gives you something that you have to pay down, and that really funnels your financial decisions versus, you know, there's a goal in front, I guess what I'm
right.
saying. You adjust to that.
Yeah. You're invested. It lights a fire under my
pun
butt
intended.
To pay that HELOC back, to not be, you know, paying the interest on that. And yeah, really, I mean, and everybody knows this, but you need to live below your means. So I think, you know, if you're making money, live below what you're making so you can save that money. It's a novel concept.
And it's honestly, it's not sexy. Like, that's the reality. You know, the podcast, the guys who we look at their success, their highlight reel.
Yeah.
The ones that are honest are like, it takes hard work. You know, I remember talking to a real estate guy, very humble, down to earth, had some self-storage units. And he told me, it's like I was young in my career. So you ever have those moments where somebody who you look up to a little bit says something and you're like that little kid and you're just kind of like hanging on every word they say? And I felt like time stopped. And he's like, son, the average millionaire wears a $40 watch. Yep. And I was like, shoot, that could be like a book title or something. But it's true because, you know, a lot of the people that we see on Instagram, they wear it on their sleeve. And we yep. were talking to another guy yesterday. He's like, people could look like they have everything.
Yep.
You don't know how much debt they have. Like, we have a lot of people yep. in the real estate world who have bought some really big properties, tackled some big projects, and you don't know how they financed it, what their numbers look like, if they were wise about it. But on the outside, you'd be like, well, he drives a Tesla. He's got to be doing well. And fortunately, success isn't built that way. It's that slow, consistent, deliberate action.
Yep.
Investing's the same way, you know, with what we're talking about.
We're going to jump into our smaller pockets here. So, Jacob, I know we're not talking specifically in real estate here, but tell us about something that went wrong. It could be within your career, within the financial planning. It could even be your personal home. What do you got for us?
Yeah, I'll share a bit of an embarrassing one. So, got my social media account was hacked, and as a financial advisor, you know, lately I think one of the taboo things is being associated with crypto scams. Well, lo and behold, the person that nabbed my social media started advertising crypto.
No way.
On my social pages.
Whoa.
Yeah. So I was able to get that back after a few days, but. There is some damage that was done. I had a lot of people, like close friends, like without even texting me first, just unfollow me.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
They were like, Jacob's falling to this. Man, he must
be
struggling.
And I don't know, you know, I don't know, or, you know, somebody, maybe they just thought, they knew I was hacked and, you know, but either way, it was, you know, embarrassing. Yeah. So make sure, you know.
How did you find out that your account had been hacked?
I couldn't get in and I couldn't log into it. And then, my wife was looking at her Instagram and noticed it was like somebody posting a picture of me, but advertising crypto.
You're like, that's weird. She's like, are you into crypto?
In the photo, you know, like you're holding a Dogecoin.
It was even worse. It was even worse than that. So like they basically just took my profile picture and just added some little details about crypto. You know, it was.
So what was the scam?
Trying to get people to click a link to invest in crypto somewhere.
Yeah. Okay. And sending them money to, you know, get access to their secret strategy.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it was pretty, like it was an emotional play for sure.
So
like,
what's the advice there for people out there with socials? What have you learned to protect your social against that? I mean, why did your social become vulnerable?
Yeah. So it was through a direct message from a family friend whose account had already been hacked. And it was a perfect storm because the guy that had got hacked, he was somebody that like was very well respected and cared for. And so when he got hacked, like I had no reason to think it wasn't him.
Right.
Wow. And so he sent me a message and then I clicked on something and I immediately realized right away that it was a scam. But I think I inadvertently clicked on something else back when I went on Instagram. So it was kind of like a two-part thing going on.
Whoa.
Yeah.
It definitely was like a gotcha moment.
It all like, happens like, it happened, you know, very super quickly. Fast.
Yeah.
How did you then communicate to the people who were following you? Like, how did you unravel that?
I basically just had to do a request through Instagram to like have them
take
that person off. And there's like a process. And I mean, it felt awful there for about 72 hours.
Right.
You know, it was like stressful. I'm like, oh my
gosh.
Did
you do a follow-up post? Like, hey guys, you probably saw some stuff in my account.
I did. But it was kind of one of those things where the people that either don't look at social media or don't care.
Didn't know.
They didn't even know. And then the people that noticed it had unfollowed me.
Wow.
So, which, you know, I post pictures of my kids, so it wasn't like a huge deal. But just in terms of like, I really don't know what kind of reputation.
Professional credibility.
Yeah, like what kind of professional credibility was kind of like, what's going on? You know, never a good thing to see when you're.
That's a different, smaller pocket story.
So watch out for your social media accounts.
And it's only getting worse with AI because, you know, you can get a FaceTime from somebody pretending to be your mom.
What? Nuh-uh.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Seriously?
It's already happening overseas, yeah.
And you don't recognize
AI, so yeah, I mean, anybody can, if you go to an AI image generation website and they're out there, you basically just give it like three photos of somebody.
You're freaking out.
And then
you
type in, hey, I want a video of this person explaining this and asking for this.
What?
And it'll create audio and everything.
That's crazy.
This is why we can't have nice things, is because of that kind of stuff. That is
coming.
And this is why people have trust issues. Because of that kind of stuff, the deep fakes.
The scams are only getting better.
Well, did you guys see some of the stuff, you know, with the wars in the Middle East? it was reported by one of the major news outlets as like, hey, so and so did this to these people. You know, here's the war atrocities going on in the Middle East. Turns out it was like
fake,
a Gears of War promo.
What?
Yeah. It was like a video game promotion made with an AI.
No.
And then it just copy and pasted it. And yeah.
And people ate it up.
People ate it up as like, oh my gosh, they did this.
Well, you know? Dude, people that do that are doing little social experiments. Like, what would happen if I just did this? Right. Yeah. And see what the response is. Shame on those people.
Yeah.
Here's the moral of the story. Know who you're dealing with. Right. And it goes back to relationship.
Yep.
You want to have meaningful relationships with the people on your team, your advisors.
Maybe financial advice from social media isn't the move.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's the takeaway. Here's the takeaway too. If anybody's asking you for money on social media, stop. Just say no.
Yes.
Stop. And then if you know that person, why don't you just call them?
Are you in Kenya right now and you're in prison and you need $4,500 in ransom money?
It's not even that outlandish. It can be even more subtle.
So, from a brokerage perspective, we'll get emails from our quote unquote broker.
Yeah.
So Jeff,
all the time.
Jeff
yeah.
will be, I'll get an email. I'll be sitting in a meeting looking at Jeff, and I'll get an email. I'll be like, hey, man.
From Jeff.
Can you send me like $400 in eBay gift cards? I want to send these to the agents and I'll get you back. And I'm like looking at Jeff. I'm like, this is Jeff. Oh, shoot.
That seems even wilder than my experience.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you think they got that information?
I've gotten those emails too. I don't know.
With realtors, you post your contact information everywhere.
Okay.
And so then somehow
everyone has your email, your phone number.
But what they do is they create an email. Excuse me, an email that like
shows up
really
as Jeff.
Close.
They move
to
a
his.
Period or yes. a letter yes. somewhere. Around. They flip it around,
and you're just kind of like, "Oh, Jeff," and you're not paying attention. Well, the handle for it is not exact, and
right.
And Jeff, if you know Jeff, he wouldn't ask you for $400 eBay gift cards.
He'd ask you for $400 eBay. I'm just kidding. All right, we're gonna go into what we call our little nugget. So, Jacob, this is the part of our show where you give our listeners a practical takeaway. Piece of advice that they can implement to their real estate investing businesses, to their investment portfolio. Kind of what would you leave our listeners with?
I'm going to go in the direction of just thinking about your purpose and understanding what is really important to you. There's a movement in financial services. It's called ESG. It stands for environmental social governance, and that's kind of like the mainstream name for it. There are other more faith-based versions of this where when you're investing, you not only think about that, but you also think about how it ties into like your values as an investor.
What are the companies I'm investing in doing with my money?
Exactly. And that's something that gets very quickly overlooked, especially unfortunately in a lot of like 401ks, because you just buy index funds. Right. And if you looked at the individual companies in those index funds, I mean, there are strip clubs that are publicly traded in the S&P 500, payday lending companies, you know,
tobacco companies, alcohol companies,
yeah.
Right.
Companies that you may not necessarily agree with their mission.
Right. And so as you allocate your God-given capital in the world. I don't know for sure, but you know, the parable of the talents, yeah. Right? The owner comes back and says, "What did you do with what I gave you?" Mm-hmm. And why, as investors now here in 2023, heading into 2024, would we not expect God to ask that same question?
Yeah.
Right. So, how did you allocate the real estate property? You know, was it I don't know exactly what kind of moral questions you could ask of real estate. Like, was it near certain things or not? You know, what made that real estate property appealing? Was it
how'd you treat your tenants?
How'd you treat your tenants? All those kinds of things.
Yeah,
it's the same for stocks. So, just understanding, you know, how your money's being invested by the hands that you're putting it into. And I would say don't get hung up on that, you know, right away, because I think there's a lot of financial literacy that builds up to that kind of a question. That's probably like a higher level question, but it also doesn't necessarily have to be. I mean, if you feel a strong conviction to not profit from a certain industry, you just have to do a little bit of research to find out if the investment vehicle you're using is exposed to certain things, and then just looking for alternatives because they're out there. They're just, you know, like it's like a diamond in the rough. There are companies out there that you know, are doing things the right way. And you know, everybody's beliefs are different. I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, you shouldn't be investing in this or that.
But be aware of what you're investing in.
Being aware and understanding how your money's making money, because I think there, at the end of the day, there is going to be some accountability for that.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's something that gets talked about very often.
So how does that play out with your personal investment planning, your retirement accounts? I mean, do you go through there and, I mean, are you implementing that now, or is that something you're researching to implement down the line, or how does that work for
you? A little bit of both. So if I'm going to take an individual name as part of my investment portfolio, I'm not only doing due diligence on the financial aspect of the company, but like, what's the company's mission? And that obviously gets harder to do. It's not easy to do. It can become hard to do if you're thinking about investing in a larger company that maybe has you know, subsidiaries and, you know, different things going on, you know, different lines of business. But, yeah, like if I'm going to buy something that's an individual name, part of my vetting is also like, you know, how that company's making its money, not just how good it is at making money.
So a conversation that we often have with our kids, they're getting older, and this is stuff I wish my parents would have talked about. And I'm not faulting them that they did it. It just wasn't, they probably didn't have the means to have this conversation, but we talk about our country and, the concept of democracy and capitalism and how capitalism is really you getting to vote with your dollars. And so, there's some really great resources out there. The Tuttle Twins, they have some awesome history stuff that kind of unfolds this for kids, to understand it at a base level. But that's what you're talking about. When you're investing, you're voting with your dollars in the companies that you believe in.
Yep.
And in an ideal world, that's when capitalism thrives, is people have the ability to do that. Obviously, things get a little wonky then when the government steps in or overreaches that. But
there's also corporate corruption too. But
right.
There is.
Conversation for another day, perhaps.
That is. So, all right, landing the plane here. What's been one of the best resources for you? Could be personal growth, business development in the last 12 months.
The best, honestly, I've been really looking forward to this podcast, just because getting in a room with people that, I mean, admittedly, I'm not a real estate person, but just getting in conversations with other humans that have the life experience to go along with the knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So applied knowledge. Mm-hmm. How do you get that? Well, that's just breaking bread with people and spending time with other like-minded people.
Yeah.
So just, you know, I would say, If that's something you want to do, I would just think of, okay, who's the smartest person that I know when it comes to finances, and then find out who that person knows.
And so it's like-minded people, but it's also people that maybe complement an area that, you know, you're not well versed in, that you want to grow in.
Yep.
And so that's good advice.
Absolutely.
What would it look like for people to find out more about you, follow your success? How can we point our listeners to
that? I'm on LinkedIn, and my Facebook is not hacked. So.
Perfect.
We'll put those links in our show notes, man. But we're excited today to bring on somebody, to your point, that complements something that we do as a way to kind of educate listeners. Maybe something that they should look further into, and that is not in the real estate bucket, but could kind of parlay well with that. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for the invite, and appreciate the time.
As always, excited that you joined us on another episode of the Reinvest Podcast. If this episode added to your tool belt or left you feeling inspired, go ahead and share it with a friend. Stay tuned every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you want to get in touch with us, go to our LinkedIn or Facebook profiles and shoot us a message. Move farther, reach higher, and grow deeper. See you next time.